Anna.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm okay. Running and returning again. That's my speed.
That time
Brandela.
again. Hello, Brandy.
Hey.
You have a question.
I have a comment. Kind of like
Well,
a
hold it.
question. Okay.
Okay. Hannah, why don't you ask your question and then we'll hear Brandy's comment.
Okay. Well, this was a question that came up on Hoshana Rabbah, as to which direction is the Hakafot on the Hoshana Rabbah done? Is it clockwise or counterclockwise? And I'll tell you kind of what before you answer the question. We weren't sure till the last minute whether or not we could actually go out in the sukkah because it rained really, really hard that morning, all morning long, and it's been raining for days, so it was like squishy. I couldn't put the tables out. So I kind of had to set up the living room. We cleared the coffee table in case we had to put the Torah scroll on the coffee table. Last year, we found that to make the Hakafot, the circle around the sukkah, the ladies got tired and couldn't do all seven circuits. But then, if we made it inside the sukkah with one table with the Torah scroll on it, the circle was so sharp that while the verses, that are the poetry verses for each day of Sukkot and all seven on Hoshana Rabbah, that they got dizzy. So I told them if we were going to be inside and go around the coffee table with the Torah scroll on the coffee table, that whatever position they started in, even if I was still reading the poetry verse, stop wherever they had started because it was a very short path. And just what I told you, that the shorter the circuit, the smaller the circuit, the you would get dizzy. And
Right.
so then it was the question, okay, well, the direction. Well, my katoya, I had so much going on, I was not able to, I didn't make the class is on Hoshana Rabbah, and I just didn't get to refresh my memory on things. And so the pre-teaching and what to do as to what we were about to do, it just had to, it just came out. It was fine, but it just came out. So my response was, I thought of the ritual that we do before we start the fast, and that we turn the glass of water counterclockwise. And because the code has so much to do with water, and especially with the willow being elevated on Hoshana Rabbah, and you would have had a water pouring ceremony. And so I said, well, that's basically what we chose to do, was to make the circuit counterclockwise.
The decision was correct. It goes counterclockwise.
Okay. So the connection, I didn't know if that would be an example of intuition or if it was seeing the connection. Because if you haven't been able to look over notes to refresh yourself from the year before that, I think this is probably maybe our fourth year that we've been able to do the ritual. Last year it fell on a Wednesday, and Donna was working, and Brandy and Judy couldn't come on a Wednesday, so it was just Helen and I and Tony in our sukkah, but we connected by telephone. I mean, you see the efforts that we have to go through. The year before that, it was a Sunday. The year before that, it was a Sunday. And the first time, Judy came and Tony and I, we went to the synagogue and we actually did it. You know, I had the keys to the synagogue and nobody's there on Sunday. But we did it on the Bema with... But the next year, I didn't feel comfortable in going back. To me, that time was like a practice that I would have done it with my students the next year. But when the next year came around, there was a lot of talk about conversations that this was not an Orthodox shul, it was a Reform shul, and I just didn't feel comfortable in going back to the synagogue to do it. So we, you know, we performed the ritual in our sukkah. But then the next year was Wednesday, which we couldn't get together, so we did it by telephone. And then this year, it was back to Sunday again. And then I'm happy to report, because we can get together on a Sunday, because we're all from, you know, anywhere from an hour away to a little over an hour away even. So traveling is involved. And almost everybody lives in a different city. In fact, everybody does. And but I was happy when I looked over, I looked at the calendar, and next year Hoshana Rabbah falls on a Sunday again. So that gives us another opportunity, God willing, that we would be able to, you know, be together again. And so anyway, that's, you kind of see what we have to go through in order to practice what we've learned.
Yes.
We also were able to read the final waters ritual after our meal. So before we did Birkat HaMazon, and anyway, the teachings really did help us a lot.
Glad to know it. But you did it correctly, going counterclockwise, and the reason that you went go counterclockwise is the same reason that we lean to the left when saying the Shema. Because you're putting your right side over your left side when you do that. And if you think about it going down...
I didn't know we'd lean to the left when saying the Shema. I knew we'd lean to the left at that spot during the Seder.
Well, you don't have to lean quite as far on to say the Shema. It's just a slight leaning to the left. But it's to put your right shoulder over your left. Put the right side over the left is... what you're doing.
Okay.
And when you go counterclockwise, you're essentially putting
right.
Your right over the left.
Over the left. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
Brandy, you wanted to make a comment.
Yeah, I had to unmute. The other day I was noticing we have a word in Hebrew called kavanah. You always say it all the time, intention. What's our intention? And I was noticing, I don't get into politics a lot, but I was looking at the word of the man that's running for, I guess, judge, Supreme Court, whatever, anyway. And his name is Kavanah. It has A-U-G-H. And that's kind of like some of the words in Texas we spell one way. When you get to Louisiana, it's A-U-X. And it means intention. And I'm looking at everything happens for a reason. And I'm always asking, am I in the right place? Am I where I'm supposed to be? And I'm always getting confirmation, at least for me, whether it's from a card or a person that gives me a word or some, or something comes across the TV every once in a while. So there has to be something between Kavanaugh and Kavanaugh. And I was wondering if maybe you had, you know, some kind of gut feeling about it, or don't laugh. I'm trying.
Who's laughing?
I thought you were laughing.
No, nobody's laughing. Nobody's laughing.
Okay.
It's a serious question. First off, you have to recognize that his name is his family name.
Right.
And I don't know we would have to go back through what the source of the family name is to really be able to answer the question. But there is a whole concept in words that sound alike are connected and they can be substituted for each other. But mostly it's a connection. So the answer to your question intuitively is Kavanaugh and Kavanaugh, the man's family name and the word in Hebrew, there is a relationship, there is a connection. What is that connection and what is the meaning of that? I haven't thought about sufficiently to address it. But there definitely is a connection.
Okay.
Brandy,
well,
do you remember when you told me about it and you told me a connection? And I said, maybe. Or could be. Do you remember what you told me?
No, I just remember it's probably an answer or... I don't remember. You know, sometimes those things just pop out.
Well, do you mind if I say it?
I don't mind at all.
Well, you asked me if I thought that there might be a connection that he was exposing the Kavanaugh of the intention of the other party that was opposing him.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Or is he demonstrating the intention that of the group that opposes him, or is he showing the intention of those who support him? Or is he showing his own intention that he has all of this writing that he has done that indicates he's already made up his mind on all of these major issues?
That's something interesting. I didn't think about that point, but that's a good point.
Well, there's always so many, you know, 70 probably. Just, and all of them, and all of the proof.
Exactly.
Or all of them are locked. Right. Okay.
Well, we just said 4, so there can't be 70 left. So there has to be 66 left.
we'll agree with you, Brandy.
Thank you. Now you can laugh.
I'm thinking of second grade subtraction. That's what I'm thinking. That's what made me laugh. I wasn't laughing at you. When you live to be as old as me, you experience just about anything, and a memory will flash back.
Do
you know, I could see those were third graders, you know, subtracting 70 from 4 or 4 from 7, you know.
We understand. Does anybody have any other questions?
I have one.
Go ahead.
What if, like, this past week, you know, we've had just tremendous amount of rain every day. I couldn't put a sukkah up where I live because it rained every single day. So I was real thrilled when Miss Barbara invited me over because I had not been in a sukkah all week, well, most of the week. And so what happens with that situation? If maybe you can do virtual. I think we talked a little bit about that at Miss Barbara's. What happens if you can't get into a sukkah? To do the festival of that week. I mean, how do you handle that?
I was going to say, can I share my experience?
Sure.
This time? Well, it didn't look like we were going to be able to put up a sukkah. The few days before that we had, and the people that we had help with, my son-in-law, was working, and then he had to go to San Antonio to pick up his mother, and then they got caught in the rain and couldn't leave San Antonio because of the flooding situation there. And yet, you know, we also put the sukkah up at the synagogue every year, and Tony didn't do any of that. And the person who, well, it ended up my son-in-law the day before we left to go to Lafayette. He and my daughter and one other person went and put the sukkah up at the synagogue, okay? And then the president came to my house to get the decorations that I had. And, you know, normally I'm the one that sets up the table in the sukkah and when we do Kiddush and Motzi, and got my tablecloth and those decorations, but he didn't say anything about helping us. Yet we talked about, well, it looked like we weren't going to have a sukkah here at our house. And the year before, Donna, Malka, and her friend, and another one of my students, Brian, they came and put up our sukkah. And they really had to, I mean, it was a work of love because they had a graduation, a son graduating or something. I don't know, something he had to be to, and yet. And I mean, it was a rush. His mother was with dementia and, you know, and but anyway, they came and put up our sukkah. And not only that, one of my neighbors, that her husband was sick and yet had to get back to their home in order to be able to do whatever they needed to do. That was a family thing. And so this year I thought to myself, I'm not going to ask Hashem, if you're my friend, you're gonna send somebody to put up that sukkah. If not, I'm gonna have a virtual sukkah. Well, the first day was Avraham, and I was sitting at my kitchen table in the kitchen and looking at my back door thinking, you know, usually I could see the sukkah from that way. So I just started putting the sukkah together in my head, which to me is a meditation. And I put the back wall and the left wall, you know, right wall, the walls up anyway. And when I went to put our roof, because our roof is a pallet of cane, we actually got it in Israel and just brought it back with us. But when I went to put the roof on, there was a cloud above it, and I didn't put the cloud there. I mean, there was a cloud, and that was, you know, here I was placing these pieces like pieces of a puzzle in my meditation, but when I went to put that pallet of bamboo, there was the cloud, and I didn't put the cloud. And so I felt like
I felt more relief that I wasn't going to have a cyst. It was going to be, I can't say not the first time we didn't have one, because we didn't have one the year of Hurricane Rita, because we had just gotten back from having been evacuated for 2 weeks, and the yard was full of trash and shingles and balls and gutter and fences and from the whole neighborhood. And, you know, so there was no putting up a sukkah that year. But other than that, we've had a sukkah for probably 30 years. And, but it made me feel better. It didn't make me not be, you know, just super happy that I didn't have one. But seeing that cloud that I didn't put, and I mean, even though we know the stories in, from the Torah about the clouds following the Hebrews in the wilderness, I never pictured a cloud above my own personal sukkah. And then Brandy called me and told me that, don't be surprised if I show up at your door. And I said, Brandy, don't you show up here, because one person can't put it up. It takes three. At least, and Tony can't help you. And so she didn't say anything, so I didn't think any more of it. Well, she showed up with two very tall men, and one was a Baptist minister, and the other was a young, strong, tall black man. And I mean, they were a delight. It was a wonderful experience, but the sukkah got put up. So what happens? We have that sukkah went through all that trouble. Brandy had to drive for an hour at least. We had to come and do the shaming besides that. And then it rains every day. And all we had to do is, Tony and I, is go out there one time for lunch. You know, of course, and what happened with Hoshana Rabbah, I mean, it was really, to me, the most wonderful Sukkot I've ever had. But I felt like the reason we were having all the rain was because it was soft judgment. We missed the hurricane. The hurricane went more to the east than to the west to hit our area, but that it was still, you know, we were still lacking in merit, and so we missed out. A lot of people missed out, and it wasn't just the rain; it was rain and sickness, and even a death. So, you know, anyway, just that picture of that cloud that I didn't put in my meditation only strengthened certainty to know that if you didn't have a sukkah, if you couldn't put up a sukkah, then you have a virtual sukkah. And then I could relate back to probably, I'm sure that's what people in the Holocaust did for Shabbat, and when the holidays would come around, and, you know, that... you can do it. And I'm sorry if that took so long.
Thank you for sharing. Now I will tell you the story that I read today, because last night when we were reading the Tzaddikim, one of the Tzaddikim stuck out to me. He was a particular, he'd been given a name of a certain Rebbe, a certain court of the Hasidic movement. He was, you know, it wasn't that he was given it, but that was his lineage. As I remember, it starts with an R, but I'm not sitting in front of the list where I can remember what it is. But this morning, when I was reading my various 200 emails a day, there was a story about him, a very short story, but essentially he arrived in the United States after the Shoah, just as Sukkot was starting. And that particular year in New York, where he arrived, was a very rainy season, a very rainy Sukkot. And they were not able to really keep do the mitzvah like he wanted to do. They only had one day where they were able to eat in the sukkah. So after Sukkot was over, he asked his parishioners, he asked the people that had brought him over to be their leader, where in the United States can I go so I can keep Sukkot properly? And they pointed him towards Los Angeles as being a good area for being able to keep Sukkot because of the weather. And also there was a number of Jewish people there. So he went to Los Angeles, and he stayed in Los Angeles. The group that brought him over were still living in New York. He started, he built up his own community in Los Angeles, but essentially he was only there because he wanted to keep the mitzvah of Sukkot. And that is every person has one mitzvah that is theirs, that they make theirs, that they come into the world for it to be very important. It's the mitzvah that speaks to their soul. And for him, it was Sukkot. For Rabbi Berg, it was the Kaddish. Rabbi Berg never missed a Kaddish. He always prayed with a minyan for something like 30 years. That was his mitzvah. So each person has to pick the mitzvah that speaks to them. And this particular Rabbi, it was Sukkot, and he was devastated that year that he couldn't keep it properly. So he left his community in order to be able to keep it properly for 30-some years prior to his passing.
There's also another story. I used to tell it to the children. But then one year, usually with visiting rabbis, we have a rabbi from Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and then they go back home, and then it's the white person that has to do Sukkot. And it was always, one day in the hall and setting it up, and since the year 2000, we had been putting up the Sukkot at the synagogue as well. So, and you kind of had to get the service as short as you could because we had to go out in the super to do Kiddush and mostly out there. And so that year, in place of a devotor or along with the devotor, I don't remember, I took that story. It was two characters, and we kind of dramatized it. There was a man named Mordecai, and there was a traveler on the road. And Mordecai had saved all year so that he would be able to buy beautiful lulavim, lulav, and an etrog for Sukkot. And he left his home to travel to go get that lulav and etrog for Sukkot. And on the way, he met this man who had a wagon and a horse, and his horse
he was crying, or they, you know, what am I going to do? Or not. And I'm about to get home, and, you know, so the man asked him how much, what did he need to buy another horse, and naturally it was the same price as what he would pay for his Lulav and a truck, so he gave him the money. And went back home, Mordecai did, without his Lulav and a truck. But when Sukkot actually did come around, he said, well, everybody else was celebrating Sukkot with their Lulav and Etrog, but he was remembering that his Lulav and Sukkot that year was a horse with someone else, with the moral being that Tzedakah outweighed the reward of the Lulav and Etrog that year. And it also went back to saying, you know, Tzedakah spares one from death. And anyway, so I think that shows us when we can't do, or we can't, circumstances prevent us, whether, like, I couldn't light Shabbat candles because Tony got admitted to the hospital at 3 o'clock on Friday afternoon. And even if you had candles, they should, well, they, you know, you just can't do it. And,
they don't let you light candles in the hospitals, he says.
They do?
They do not.
Oh, I didn't think so. Well, here they wouldn't even know what you're doing. You know, so if you said you light candles, they wouldn't know what you're doing. But anyway.
It's not light candles. They just don't do it on Friday night.
Yeah. So anyway, I think that's an answer. If ever the time got to bed, that's where we can't do some of these things, whether it's because we're getting older or because other circumstances get in the way. I think knowing that, what do we want to call it, virtual reality is real. And there's not feeling like that since I saw that cloud, and I didn't put that cloud up. I was trying to put my roof on.
Well, it came from somewhere, you know that.
Oh, yeah, I know, but it wasn't me. I didn't do it. You know, it wasn't the puzzle piece I was putting in my meditation. But gosh, did it ever. It was just a blessing. And I felt like, even though it's a personal story, it was well worth sharing with anybody that would listen, because it's real.
I understand.
Mm-hmm.
Does anybody have any other questions? Or comments? Then you all have a beautiful evening, and tomorrow's classes are at 4:30 Pacific time. We'll continue our study of section 11 on Lech Lecha, and tomorrow night we'll have a Zohar class on the Parasha of Bereshit.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night, Joel.
Good night.
Good night, all.